On this episode of This Week in Linux, Linus Torvalds announced the Linux 5.0 kernel is coming soon. We got some Linux mobile news from UbiPort's Ubuntu Touch and Purism's Librem 5. Then in app news, Bash 5.0 is out, and we'll check out some new interesting apps like a new password manager and a subtitle syncing tool. In distro news, we'll look at some news from Clonezilla Live, Fun2, and Fedora. Later in the show, we'll check out some security news for Metasploit and a new two-factor authentication phishing tool. Then we'll finish out the show with some Linux gaming news for SuperTuxCart and a story about my uncle. All that and much more coming up. I'm Michael Tanell with Tux Digital, and it's your weekly source for Linux GNUs. This episode of This Week in Linux is sponsored by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean offers the simplest, most developer-friendly cloud platform. It's optimized to make managing and scaling apps easy with an intuitive API, multiple storage options, integrated firewalls, load balancers, and much more. You can get all this plus access to their world-class customer support for as low as $5 per month, or you can use their flexible pricing structure for as low as 0.7 cents per hour. That's only 0.7 cents per hour. DigitalOcean also has 2,000 cloud-agnostic tutorials to help you stay up to date with the latest open-source software, languages, and frameworks. You can get started by going to DigitalOcean for free with a $100 credit. That's a $100 credit by going to do.co/tux or do.co/tux. And just a side note, I'm going to be starting a new thing with a droplet I'm about to launch up this week, and it's going to try to sync up the Telegram and the Discord and the IRC and the Matrix chat and some other stuff, so I can have them, like, the goal is to have all the different chats synced up, so no matter which platform you use, you can be in part of the conversation. So we'll see if that works. If it does, awesome. If not, well, you know, it's worth a shot. But anyway, if you want to try something like that, you can get started with a $100 credit by going to do.co/tux or do.co/tux. Up first this week is the Linux 5.0 kernel has been announced by Linus Torvalds that it's coming soon. And what's interesting about it is that this is not really any huge major change, even though the number implies that it is, because a lot of times software and programming, they usually use the main number to indicate a big massive breakpoint or a big major overwrite and things like that. In this case, it's really just because. Which I find that's pretty funny, really. So they were going to call it the 4.21 kernel, and they decided to just stop at 20 and then create jump from 20 to 5.0. And really, there's just because they wanted to. And I think that's pretty good, because that's funny, because they kind of started that process in the 3 series, where when they had the 2.x, I think they went up to like, it was definitely over 26. I'm not sure exactly when they stopped. I'm pretty sure it was 26 when they stopped. But they got to the 3, they just decided to move it up to 3.0, then the 4, same thing. So it seems like the new structure that they do it is just when they feel like doing it, which I think that's pretty funny. But in this, Linus Torvalds, in this article, in this mailing list post, he says that about 50% of the new version will be drivers, 20% of it is architecture updates, 10% is tooling, and the remaining 20% is a bunch of stuff like documentation, networking, file systems, and many more. So nothing in particular stands out. But they are removing some ancient drivers, as Linus puts it, which is, and specifically is ISDN, which I'm surprised still exists. One of the really cool things about it is that AMD FreeSync is getting support for the AMD GPU. So the open source version of the AMD drivers paired with the Mesa 19.0 will be able to use the FreeSync or the VESA adaptive sync over DisplayPort. And this is one of the few things that has been missing from the open source drivers for the AMD cards. So this is going to be a really, really big thing for them. So overall, it's a lot of just the main thing, the constantly iteration of new features and just improving the overall kernel. But there are quite a few things that are coming. Like last week, we talked about the Raspberry Pi getting touchscreen support, and that's going to be in the 5.0. There's also going to be some improvements for 4K screens and things like that. So if you have a 4K screen, you'll be able to get better views for the Terminus console font, for example, and many more things. So we expect to see release probably around the end of February or early March. That's based on like the current, they don't really have an exact scheduled date for a release, but based on the current structure of how often they update, it's probably going to be around somewhere around there. So if you'd like to learn more, I'll have a link to the mailing list post in the show notes. Up next in the show is Ubuntu Touch OTA 7 has been released. And if you've been following on with the show for Destination Linux as well as This Week in Linux, you might know that I currently am using a Ubuntu Touch phone, well, Ubuntu Touch on a phone, and playing around with it for a little bit. And it's not my primary right now, but because it's not really ready for it, but it's very, very close for primary. It has all the best things about, like, you know, it's got all the main basics and stuff. So you just got like a browser, and it's got a the phone's functionality and the keyboard, decent keyboard structure. Like overall, it works pretty good. The thing that's about this is that they have changed to their release structure is now going to be doing it on a monthly basis. They haven't said exactly if it's always going to be the month or it's going to be like, you know, give or take a little bit. But for the most part, it's going to be on like much more rapid development as far as like their releases and things like that. So just a little bit over a month since OTA 6, they're now releasing OTA 7. And in OTA 7, they've done a lot of improvements. For example, they've given some improvements to the Morph browser, like the ability to close current tabs in the tab switcher view and prevent the device from sleeping when a video is playing. And they've also done some options for default and per page zooming. And they've done some compatibility fixes for multiple devices and driver improvements and things like that, as well as improve the theming for the keyboard so that you can now choose to have a light or dark dark colored keyboard, as well as you can customize her being more like fancier or like a flat design and things like that. So overall, I think that the Ubuntu Touch operating system for your phone is quite good, and I think it has a ton of potential. And, you know, hopefully in the future I'll get like a Librem 5 and put Ubuntu Touch on it, because they did say that they were going to have support for Ubuntu Touch on the Librem 5. So that would be great. So overall, if you do have Ubuntu Touch, a phone that's running it, you absolutely need to update, because this is definitely worth it. So if you want to find out more about this, as well as, you know, try to see if your devices have support for it, you can go to ubports.org/devices, or you can check a link in the show notes. Speaking of the Librem 5, Librem 5 has got a progress update for the end of the year of 2018 from Purism, and there's a lot of stuff that's been going on for this one. It's really nice to see that. They've got basic functionality for the calls application to work, and they've also done it where they have basic features like ringtones and things like that. They also have a new daemon that interfaces between the SIMCOM SIM7100 modem and Pulse Audio, so you can configure Pulse Audio to work with a phone call. And this daemon is called, I'm going to butcher this, it's a Dutch word, I think, and it's Hegtisse. I gave it a shot. Anyway, there's also some improvements for the libhandy library for adapting GTK3 applications to be more applicable to the form factor of mobile phones. There's also been work on the Vert board as the Wayland-based virtual keyboard. Then Purism's chatty application also now has encrypted chat support, as well as SMS, text messages and things like that. As well as they've added new mockups for the GNOME software that's been modified to work with a mobile UI and things like that. And they've also seen some improvements to the WL routes as their Wayland implementation for the backend. So there's quite a few things that I haven't listed yet. There's, you know, tons of things. If you want to check out the blog post for the Purism website, I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Up next in the show is the release of Bash 5.0, or Bash as in the Born Again Shell. And Bash, this version has a lot of new variables and improvements. We're going to talk about a few of them. Like the first one we're going to talk about is the Bash_argv0. And it's basically what this does is it expands the name of the shell or shell script. So similar to how the old variable, the global variable of $0 would allow you to do that. So it's like the, if you type in the name of a shell script and you use this variable, it will check to see what the name of the shell script that you just ran is, and then use that so you can just not have to include that specifically in the script. They've also added epoch seconds as another variable, and this expands the number of seconds since the Unix epoch or the timestamp, which was like January 1st, you know, midnight January 1st, 1970. I think that's when it was. And there's also epoch real time. It's similar to epoch seconds for attaining the number of seconds since the Unix epoch, but this version is a floating point with microsecond granularity. They've also done some updates to the bash history. So you can now, with a new built-in history, you can remove ranges of history entries pretty quickly. So instead of having to go into your bash logs and stuff like that, you can go to, you know, edit it directly inside of the shell. And there's been quite a few bug fixes and many more things. So there's a, you know, big list of stuff. You want to check it out in the show notes. I'll have a link to the post, the official release announcement from Bash, in the show notes below. Up next in the show is a new password manager. It is called Buttercup. Yep, Buttercup. Anyway, Buttercup is a password manager that is a cross-platform desktop application written in Electron. They also have mobile apps and browser extensions, so you can use your credentials in a variety of different, you know, form factors and applications and stuff like that. So if you would prefer not to use a desktop application, you want to use your browser, you can do that as well. It uses JavaScript for in the encryption structure for a, what they call a secrets vault. The way it stores it is that it stores it all in a secure archive. And I'm pretty sure it's a custom extension, like I think it's .bcup or .bcup for the actual extension of the archive. But the way they do it is typically they would want you to store it on your computer, kind of like how KeePass does it, where it stores it directly on the computer that is trying to use it. Or you could use it in a syncing service like Dropbox or something like that, where you could encrypt the file. You know, the file is automatically encrypted, I mean, but you have an encrypted file on one of these services, and then you can, like, set up those services for another computer to, you know, pull in that particular archive. It doesn't have its own self-hosting structure. You would need to use some kind of either Dropbox, or if you wanted to, like, self-host your own instance of C file or sync thing or something like that, one of those would work too, but you'd need something like that in order to do it. The archives are encrypted using AES specification, and they cannot be read by anyone, you know, unless you have the master password. So even brute forced decryption would take so long it's not even possible, really. So in this case, it has a beneficial, you know, aspects for some people who don't want to have they want to use some kind of password manager, but they don't want to use a self-host, or they don't want to use the existing things like LastPass that have, you know, premium services that you have to pay for to use them, or something like KeePass, which requires you to have a bunch of different versions of, you know, forks of projects. So, for example, with KeePass, you have to have the, you know, KeePass XC is the current one for Linux users. Then there's also, like, KeyDroid and KeyFox, and there's another one for Chrome, too, where you have to have all these different projects and, you know, set them up together so that they all work together, whereas this one is, like, an all-in-one, but it doesn't do its own, like, syncing structure, so you'd have to find a solution for that. There are other options like Bitwarden that can allow you to do a similar self-hosted approach, whereas this one is a little bit more user-friendly, as far as, like, Bitwarden would require you to set up, like, a Docker container on a server, whereas this is just, you know, a direct archive on your computer, and it might be easier to set up that way. So if you are interested, you can check out a link in the show notes to Buttercup Password Manager. And finally, in the app news section of the show this week is SubSync. It's an auto subtitle synchronization tool. SubSync is really interesting because it basically takes a subtitle file and a, you know, movie or TV show file or whatever, and then would automatically create a, you know, syncing up the subtitles with the subtitle file with the data of the audio track of whatever you're watching. You could also it doesn't really automatically create subtitles. What it does is it takes an existing subtitle file and then corrects the timestamps to display those subtitles in a proper place. So it listens to the audio in the file, in the video file, and then syncs up what the words are that are basically listed prior. So you have to transcribe it yourself, but for the most part, this is still a ridiculously good thing. If you ever had to do this before, so if you ever, you know, made, you know, any kind of content that requires you to do subtitles, it's a massive pain because you have to set up the timestamp. So you'd have to watch it and type it at the same time, and then try, and you have to go back and then set the timestamp, go back, check it, make sure it loads in properly. It's like, it's a lot of work for something that a lot of people would argue is not that much beneficial. But this is a fantastic concept because it allows you to take your subtitle files and then add the structure, you know, much, much quicker and with a lot less effort. So that's awesome. They've also got supports that with different languages. I couldn't find a listing of exactly how many languages, but it does support quite a few. And it has a different like translation things for different, like a dictionary structure for like referencing the tracks and the subtitles. It also has character encoding for auto detection for that. It has a graphical user interface in order to utilize the thing, so you don't have to like create a script to make it work. It's really cool, and it even supports drag and drop and auto updating. Because I'm pretty sure it runs for Linux users, it runs as a snap, so that's pretty cool. So it's really easy to get started with it. I haven't given a try this yet, but I do plan to, because SubSync does sound like a great tool, and it would be very beneficial for, you know, creating a podcast and things like that. As long as I don't fumble too much with my words, you know, like I have in this particular segment. Well, anyway, if you'd like to learn more about the SubSync, you can find a link to it in the show notes. Up first in distro news this week is CloneZilla Live 2.6.0-37 has been released. And CloneZilla, if you're not aware, CloneZilla Live is a distribution of CloneZilla that allows you to make copies or clones of your disks and able to store them for, you know, backup and restore and things like that. And it's a really useful tool, and it allows you to even take a system and then duplicate it on another hardware and stuff like that. So you could do a lot of, you know, really quickly. Well, not quickly, because it does take a long time to make a copy of an entire disk, but it makes it easy to do so. And CloneZilla is very, very, it's very nice to have in your toolbox. So the latest version of CloneZilla Live has updated to the Linux kernel 4.19.13. It has been updated for part clone to 0.3.12. The package LDM tool and Havaged were added. Nah, I probably said that wrong. And they've also added the curl package too. So there's a lot of improvements done to Network Manager, so that you can, you know, use, configure the network if necessary, especially for Wi-Fi to do the cloning. And they've also done some addition to the massive deployment mode. The interactive client mode was added so that the Lite server can provide the ability to enter interactive mode of CloneZilla Live in the clients themselves. They've also made it where it can handle UEFI boot and a lot of other cool features. So if you are interested in learning more about this particular release for CloneZilla Live, or just CloneZilla Live in general, you'll have a link in the show notes. Up next is Funtu. Linux 1.3 has been released. And if you're curious, Funtu is actually it's a variant style of Gentoo. It's not exactly like a derivative exactly, but it's very similar in the way that Gentoo works. Actually, Daniel Robbins was the founder of Gentoo and decided to leave Gentoo and create his own, you know, alternative, which was Funtu. And he created Funtu in 2009, and Gentoo started in 2000. Robbins left Gentoo in that same year. But the Funtu project is interesting because it doesn't provide a bootable live or installation ISO. Gentoo has a comprehensive installation manual, as well as ISOs, but Funtu also has their own comprehensive installation manual that you can follow, and it's very similar to Gentoo, but there are some distinctive differences. So if you have or interest in Gentoo, you might want to try out Funtu as well. There's also another version that's called Bentoo. It's featured on the Funtu page, and it's a kind of an easier installation version of Funtu, and it comes with a DE like GNOME or Plasma, so you can, you know, kind of easily get started. And it's an interesting way of handling that, having a, you know, Funtu, which is a very you know, basically hardcore structure of learning how the kernel works and setting all the flags for all the compilations and everything like that. It's very similar to how Gentoo works, but it also has the Bentoo version where you can do the you know, the more easily installed version of Funtoo. So anyway, what Funtoo 1.3 has moved to the LTS kernel and also now has Amazon AWS images available, so you could use it on AWS if you want to. So it also has some security and bug fixes and a bunch of things. The only thing that's kind of iffy is the fact that they have deprecated the multi-lib support, which is the ability to use 32-bit applications on 64-bit versions of a distro. So, for example, Steam is very heavily using 32-bit multi-lib stuff. So you wouldn't be able to play any games on Funtoo if you wanted to because, you know, Steam requires the multi-lib to work. So there's things like that that kind of would create, you know, some issues doing a few applications here and there. But if you want to learn more about Funtoo, you can find a link to the latest post or official for their wiki on 1.3 in the show notes. In a previous episode, we talked about the potential for Fedora 31 to have a delay for up to even a year so that they could do the retooling of their infrastructure to make it, you know, make the distribution, makes it have some fundamental changes in that so they can craft it out much more quickly and have better, they could have better updates and just a smoother experience for the development. However, we now seem that the developers have been discussing it. They've been discussing it since, you know, their first announcement in November, but they're essentially it's not going to happen. Like, we're expecting it to not happen at this point because it's still possible that they might, but the consensus so far is that they're going to, instead of doing that, they're just going to, you know, buckle down and work more to do the retooling and the infrastructure improvements while they also work on the newer versions of Fedora. So the Fedora 6 month release cadence will continue in the exact same way it has been, but they're also going to do some extra retooling stuff as well. Paul Frields announced today that they'll figure out how to accommodate, not today, sorry, this week. I don't know why I said today. They're trying to accommodate their planned work without interrupting the Fedora release cadence. And he says, after talking with the council, as well as some folks who are depending on the cadence, like IoT, it was clear we need to look at this option. But for now, I intend to remove the cadence change from the objective requirements, unless more specific reasons why it has to happen become clear. So Fedora 30 remains under development for release in May, while it looks like Fedora 31 will be targeted for somewhere around the end of October. So there's just an update for that for our previous topic that we talked about, Fedora. And if you'd like to learn more, I have a link to the announcement from Paul Frields in the show notes below. So the hardware news section, we first have IntroWare, and IntroWare launches their Aries all-in-one PC. IntroWare is a UK-based PC manufacturer that makes custom Linux PCs. They use ODM Clevo structure, so they take the hardware from Clevo and then they heavily modify it to improve the support and compatibility with the distributions that they offer, as well as, you know, most distributions too. So they create custom drivers and things like that to improve the overall experience with the hardware. So this particular one is a really nice looking all-in-one PC. It's not the first Linux manufacturer to create an all-in-one. There was the System76 Sable a couple years ago, but I couldn't find any, you know, any all-in-ones that are still available for sale. So this is currently the only one I know of, but it looks really nice and it looks like very sleek. And it's really interesting because it can be pretty powerful. So, for example, it can be customized up to an 8th gen Core i7, Intel Core i7, 32 gigs of DDR4 RAM, and 2 terabytes of NVMe storage. So it could have this, and by the way, the Core i7 would be like a 6-core Intel CPU, so like a 6 cores. It'd be a beast. So you could get a very beefy machine in an all-in-one, you know, monitor. If you're not sure what an all-in-one is, it's basically a big monitor with a computer on the back of it. And it starts out at 739 pounds because it's a UK base. They use the pound sterling. And it has a 24-inch matte HD 1080p screen. Only thing that's kind of issue is that they only offer like a couple different variations. So like the RAM can be different, the CPU can be different, things like that. But there's not, you know, a lot of big differences. You can't get a a dedicated GPU or anything like that, and you can't get an AMD version of it. It's only you can only get an Intel version. It'd be really cool if you can get an AMD like APU with it, so you can get like the combination thing that they made. That'd be pretty cool if they do like another version. But overall, this does seem like a really nice piece of hardware. If you are interested in getting a all-in-one PC, or know someone who might, this might be worth looking into. Personally, I prefer to have multiple monitors that are just kind of like dumb monitors and have like a big beefy machine on the side, just because that allows me to replace, you know, the parts more efficiently and more effectively. At the same time, they can be more powerful. But overall, this would be really cool for like a hotel lobby or, you know, an office or something like that. Just, you know, just if you want something that's very lean, but at the same time pretty powerful, this could be a good option for that. So if you want to learn more, you can go to check out the link in the show notes for the IntroWare Ares all-in-one PC. And the next hardware news is AMD has announced at CES this year that the AMD 7, Radeon 7 GPU is going to be available in February. Now, this is the first ever 7 nanometer GPU that will be available for consumer level, because they announced that the 7 nanometers was going to be made for like data centers and things like that a couple months ago. And so the turnaround between, you know, announcing that particular, you know, offering and then now announcing the one for consumers, that's not very long. So that's pretty cool that they can get it that quick. So the Radeon 7 was announced at CES, like I said, and they've done some interesting things where they built it on an enhanced second generation AMD Vega architecture. So kind of like the Vega 64, but, you know, much, you know, actually quite a few improvements over the current Radeon RX Vega 64. So they now have 60 compute units, 3,840 stream processors running at up to 1.8 gigahertz, 16 gigabytes of high bandwidth memory, second gen high bandwidth memory, up to 1 terabyte per second memory bandwidth, 4096 bit memory interface, and it's basically 35% higher performance in Battlefield 5 and up to 42% higher performance in other games. So like there's quite a few improvements to this overall offering, and if you watch the video, it's really interesting to have the CEO of AMD talk about all the things that they're doing and demonstrate the support and the performance that they have. So, for example, they just demonstrated that some of the games were getting, were running this particular Radeon 7 GPU, they were able to get like 110, 120 frames per second at the highest levels on a 4K display. So, like, that's ridiculous, because a lot of the times, you know, people expect nothing more than 60 frames at 4K because, you know, the hardware is not powerful enough. Or it's the stuff that is powerful enough is so expensive that no one wants to do it, or no one wants to pay for that. So this is really cool that they're going to be making it, you know, much more reasonable price, but also very powerful hardware. So very nice to see. And if you want to learn more about this, I'll have a link to the Gaming on Linux article that listed in the video, as well as the specific keynote video from AMD themselves at CES in the show notes. So someone mentioned something in the chat room. The Levisky in the live chat mentioned something that was kind of interesting, saying that the, you know, the card is $700 basically, and I said it was reasonably priced. What I meant is that it's a brand new innovative technology that is typically, when they release things like that, these manufacturers put the price at like ridiculous, impossible to use, like $2,000, or in case of like the NVIDIA's Titan graphics card, which is $3,000. I mean, $700 in comparison is much more reasonable than the alternatives, is all I'm saying. Like, it's not reasonably priced overall. It's not like an inexpensive card, but it is, in comparison to the other cards in the market, it's a fairly reasonable price. So, yeah, there's that. On to security news. Metasploit 5.0 has released a new version. Well, obviously 5.0, that's a new version. So they got some new data services in it. They've introduced fresh evasion capabilities. They support multiple languages now, and it builds upon their framework's growing repository of offensive security content. And offensive as in offensive, you know, attacking security. So to attack your security to make sure you can harden it. So like pen testing and things like that. So if you're interested, the Metasploit is one of those like very popular, very useful tools that are in the pen testing, the ethical hacking ecosystem, like Kali Linux and Parrot OS and things like that. So it's a very popular and a very powerful application that is very useful for pen testers. So if you'd like to learn more, you can find a link in the show notes to Metasploit 5.0. Up next is a new pen testing tool that allows you to phish two-factor authentication codes. So essentially, like every new hack provides more and more ways of seeing, like it becomes clearer that the older forms of two-factor authentication are not really protection, like reassuring protection anymore, like they used to be. Because there's a lot of different things that people are working on making, like ways to compensate or mitigate this break, so it allows you to have the ability to capture like one-time passcodes and things like that. So the probably going to butcher this, but the Modliszka, which is Polish for mantis, that's why mantis is in the video. But anyway, it's a tool that allows you to automate the phishing of one-time passcodes sent by text messages or generated by using authentication apps and things like that. Now, it's really interesting because of how powerful this could be, but there are some caveats too. It's not as big. It is not like catastrophic or anything. So on one level, the tool sits on the same server as a phishing site capturing any credentials and two-factor authentication tokens the user can be tricked into sending. But instead of like cloning the phish site, you know, like the old way of doing it, you make a website and it would just be like a copy or as close as a copy as they could from the main site. This works like a reverse proxy. So it's actually kind of really interesting, and technically speaking, it's cool in the concept because it allows you to feed the user data from the real site to make an attack look more convincing. So the users, they think that they're interacting with the real site because they actually are interacting with the real site. It's just also collecting the data as a middleman while they interact with the real site. So the proxy allows it to, you know, manipulate and work with the real site in every way. So even like Google, where you have to go through like the process of entering the Google account, then the password, then do the two-factor authentication, even through all that, you can get the codes to get in. So it's very interesting that this is possible because it doesn't, like the fact that it doesn't use like a cloning structure, but it uses like a sitting on like an extra layer on top is pretty cool as far as like, you know, conceptually how it works. It's not good in general because, you know, it's phishing, but still. But it does have limitations because the main thing is that most of these two-factor authentications have a restriction so that these codes will only work for like 30 seconds of the window once they're generated. So if you capture the code, you'd have to utilize it very quickly. Otherwise, it'd be worthless because at that point they would you'd have to get a whole brand new one to get to access it. And it also depends on being able to, you know, socially engineer a target to use a phishing site in the first place. So there are some limitations to it. It's just an interesting concept that I thought I wanted to cover because of like the reverse proxy aspects of it. And also in some cases, if you use a password manager. Some password managers have these phishing domain checking. So if you go and try to enter your password into a phishing domain that's like known as being a phishing attack, it will stop it and like let you know that it's a phishing site or a suspicious site anyway. And they also have a video demonstrating how it works. So they set up a demo account for Google and they log into a Google account. And then there's like this administration panel that once you go into the panel, you can see it'll say like imitate user. And what it does when you click that button, it will go to that website and then automatically apply the two-factor authentication codes and be on the account as that user. So in general, potentially scary because of how bad that could be. But there's also some situations where it's not really practical, and more because of the 30-second window, it's not likely to be an issue. But I still think that the idea and the concept itself is interesting. So if you want to learn more about this, I'll have a link to Modliszka in the show notes below. In some unfortunate security news, we have some security holes that have been uncovered for Systemd. The security company Qualys, probably, has some revealed some three systemd security vulnerabilities. Now, most of these security, there are two of these security vulnerabilities are much worse than the other one, but we'll get to that in a second. But first of all, most systems, most Linux distributions utilize systemd. A significant portion of those that utilize it are vulnerable to these issues. However, SUSE Linux Enterprise, OpenSUSE Leap 15, and Fedora 28 and 29 are not exploitable because they use their user space is compiled with GCC's TAC FStack Clash Protection flag. Because the reason why is that this is a variation of a Stack Overflow bug called a Stack Clash. The stack memory is forced to allocate memory to deal with a data overflow. Then it overlaps with the other memory areas, and once there, the data smashes the stack or memory space, enabling an attack possible. So there's three cases of these issues, and two of them, which is CVE, I'm not going to do the whole thing, but 16864 and 16865 are memory corruptions. And then the 16866 is out of bounds memory read. The first two, the 65 and 64, both of those have been patched already by the systemd team and are likely available in the distribution that you're using, depending on how fast those update for your distribution. More than likely pretty quick. But what happens is that it allows the multiple megabytes of command line arguments to be passed to the Linux system logger, or syslog, and that causes the systemd's journald to crash, and then this creates a hostile local user to take over the system, allows a hostile user to take over. Now, the local user part is very important. Now, this is a vulnerability, and it allows to escalate privileges and things like that, but it does require local physical access or a previously compromised system. So this is not going to allow you to compromise a system in remotely or anything. Once you've already compromised it, this could have been used as a method to escalate privileges. But other than that, you still have to somehow get into the system in the first place. So it's a vulnerability, but it's not like a remote execution issue. And two of the three have already been fixed and patched, and the other one is currently being worked on, and more than likely will be patched very soon. So another thing is that the Qualys people say that they have created some exploits for the first two things, the 64 and 65, but they're not going to release them, and they haven't released them yet, and they don't have any plans to release them anytime soon. We don't know if they're ever going to release them or not. More than likely will for proof of concept once they're done and once the patches are finished. But just to let you know, you should update your system as soon as possible if you do have one of the distros that is affected. So either not Fedora or not OpenSUSE, and then you would be probably affected. But at the same time, it's not a huge attack vector. It's just a lot of people would probably be attacking systemd because it's very common and very popular to hate systemd. So anytime there's a security vulnerability in a system like or a project like that that has a lot of hatred towards it, more than likely people are going to exaggerate how painful or how bad this situation is. And while it is a pretty bad situation, it does require you to already have a remote access, or you've already compromised the system, or you have physical local access to the system. So it's not as bad as it might be claimed in other places. So anyway, if you'd like to learn more, I have a link to the system down exploit article about this. So the link will be in the show notes. Up next in the show is some more uplifting news rather than the security issues. And that is Humble Bundle is now doing a ebook bundle for photography books. So last week we talked about, Darktable and Raw Therapy. And this week I just happened to see that they're doing a Humble Bundle for a variety of different photography books. So I think it was, very good timing, I suppose. And this has a lot of digital field guides for multiple Canon and Nikon cameras. It has books on exposure, lighting, night and low light photography, black and white digital photography. And it also has books on like specific styles of photography, like weddings and family portraits and concert photography, like the different ways of doing product photography and things like that, and a bunch more. I didn't actually get a total of how many books there were, but it looks like there's about over 20, maybe even 30 books in this. I don't know exactly how many, but it's a significant amount of books. If you were if you're interested in photography or curious about getting started with it, this might be a really good opportunity to get a lot of good guides pretty cheaply, because I think you can get all of them for like $15 or something. I think that's the highest tier is the $15 tier. So anyway, if you're interested, I'll have a link to the Humble Photography books in the bundle for it in the show notes. But before we move on, I want to let you know that the link in the show notes will be an affiliate link to the Humble Bundle. So if you do decide to purchase it and use that link, Dux Digital will get a small percentage of the purchase towards the channel. And I would really appreciate if you were to do, if you did want to buy it, that you would use that link, because that would benefit the channel and this show. So anyway, thanks again for using it if you do. And yeah, I have a link in the show notes for the Humble Photography Books bundle. So next up in the show is the Linux gaming section. And first up is a story about my uncle. This is, okay, it's a, technically it's a video game called A Story About My Uncle. And it's a really interesting game. And first up, before we talk about the game specifically, I want to let you know that that Steam has the game in a giveaway right now for free. So you can go to the Steam page. I'll have a link in the show notes for this particular game on Steam. And it's just free right now, so you can go and get it for free. This is only until January 14th, so like mid-Monday, roughly, depending on what your time zone is anyway. So that's how long it'll be available. So when this show will be, it's recorded on the 12th and will be released on the 13th. So you should have a little bit of time if you watch it quickly. Otherwise, sorry. This game is a first-person platformer, and it's a really cool gameplay system. It has like a grappling, like an electric grappling system. It's very cool. The visuals are mostly fantastic. Like, there's a lot of cool stuff about it. The visuals of it, like the areas and the paths and everything that you do, is really nice looking. The character models of yourself and the effects of the grappling hook is really cool. The NPC character models are not so good. They're not as high quality. They kind of look out of place, but it might be a style choice that they chose to do, and it does kind of give it some more quirkiness to it. But overall, I think that it just seems out of place. But the graphics look fantastic. So if you're interested in checking out a first-person platformer, I would say this is definitely worth playing. I mean, it was worth, I bought it back in the, like a couple of years ago, and it was very great then, so it's definitely worth free. So if you want to find out more or you want to play this game, I'll have a link in the show notes for the free Story About My Uncle giveaway that Steam's doing. So this is until January 14th, like I said. I don't remember exactly what time, but I think it's somewhere around like midday Eastern time or so. So yeah, link in the show notes. In a previous episode, we talked about Super Tux Cart getting online multiplayer. And I am very pleased to let you know that the online multiplayer beta has been released. So if you want to try it out, Super Tux Cart they're allowing you to download a tarball, which you extract the tarball and then run, I think it's called like run.sh or rungame.sh, something like that, in the front aspect of it. So that way it can find all the different libraries it needs that are inside the tarball. And you just run that in your console or your terminal, however you want to do it, and it'll just load the game that right there. So you'd also need to create an account, an online account, because they have their own online system. So you want to create your account, and then you want to log in. And once you do log in, you want to make sure it's up to you whether you want to save the password or not. But if you don't, you'd have to, every time you want to play online, you would need to re-log in every single time. So might want to save it, might not. It's up to you. But there's also a lot of cool things about it, because I did give it a shot. The multiplayer modes actually include regular racing, capture the flag, and some others. There's even like a soccer mode that I played a little bit. It's kind of like trying to do Rocket League combination of Super Tux Cart. It's not really anywhere close, but it's kind of fun anyway because of how, you know, silly it is. But Super Tux Card is a really fun game, and it's been around for like 18 years or something. But this new multiplayer or online multiplayer aspect to it is ridiculously improving to the game. So it makes it so much more fun to play against people you know and things like that. And it's just fun. So I've got a chance to test out the beta against Ryan, a fellow co-host of Destination Linux, as well as Dustin from Ubuntu Budgie. And we played a few races. Well, technically, they played a few races. I only played one race. And unfortunately, the default control key bindings for using a controller are terrible. Really weird structure set up in the game. So I was... unfortunately, I lost the race that I played. But it was not my fault. It was the controller's fault. It was technically the controls set up inside of Super Tux Card. That's what happened. I mean, Ryan will give you a different story, but that's what happened, okay? So if you want to try out this game, you can go download the Tarball. I have a link to that in the show notes. And maybe we should do like a community, you know, gaming night or something where we could all play like Super Tux Card online in one of the game servers and stuff. That'd be fun. So if you're interested in that, let me know in the comments or in the live chat if you're watching this live. And let me know if you'd be interested in that. I definitely want to do that. So hopefully you do as well. You'll find a link to the Tarball and the blog post for Super Tux Cards open online multiplayer beta in the show notes. And finally this week, Steam Play on the ProtonDB has reached over 500 platinum games in the database. So ProtonDB is a community website that keeps track of games and does testings to a variety of different distributions and different games to see if a game works well with Proton or the Steam Play structure with the new Steam that they announced a few months ago, or the new Steam compatibility layer that they announced a few months ago. And we now are currently, as of this recording, at 507 platinum rated games. So platinum means it just works without having to do any special launch commands or anything like that. It just works. So we actually have 507 right now of rated games, but there's also the rated trending, which means that it is these games are on the verge of being rated platinum, but they're not technically platinum yet. They just need some more testing and some things like that. Currently, it's at 578 platinum rated games. So it goes even higher when you add the trending section. So if you wanted to try it out, there's some games. There are really, really good games that are on the list, like Red Faction Guerrilla, Hitman 2, Outlast 2, Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare, Star Wars Republic Commando, and even Crazy Taxi, which is a port to PC from the Dreamcast. So it looks pretty dated because it was made on the Dreamcast, but it's still fun, and it's like a good nostalgic game. So if you want to try that, you could try that on the Proton or using Steam Play. So anyway, if you want to look at the rest of the games that are available on the ProtonDB, I have a link in the show notes. Thanks for watching this episode of This Week in Linux. If you'd like what I do here on this show, please like that smash button and be sure to subscribe. If you'd like to support the channel, we have multiple ways to contribute via PayPal, Patreon, and many more. You can find out more by going to tuxdigital.com/contribute. Or you can order the Linux is Everywhere t-shirt by going to tuxdigital.com/linuxiseverywhere. Or if you're in Europe, you can go to tuxdigital.com/linuxiseverywhereeu for shipping inside of Europe. We also have ways you can contribute without any cost to you by using our affiliate links. You can find links for places like Amazon, private internet access, and many more. You can find all these by going to tuxdigital.com/affiliates. If you'd like to submit some GNUs to the show, then visit the subreddit by going to thisweekinlinux.reddit.com. If you'd like some more podcasting goodness from me, then check out the latest episode of Destination Linux, as I'm a co-host of that show. And just a reminder, this show is live, usually, every Saturday, so join us in the live chat room to discuss all the latest Linux news each week. Thanks again for watching. I'm Michael Tennell with Tux Digital, and as always, keep using, learning, and enjoying Linux.